Well, thank you, Mr. Pearson. This is going to be my third sermon on the seven changes between the Old and the New Covenant. We won't actually get into the changes until next time, so looking at 10 sermons, I'm sure I'm going to wear you out before this is over. But I believe it's very vital information that we must understand because it was a heresy that was foisted off on the Church of God back in the 90s. And there were precious few of us who stood up against the false teaching. And I think all of us need to be enabled to be able to do that so that when it happens again, you will be forewarned and also very well prepared. Today we're going to be discussing some of the most important and impactful events in the Bible. And there is much misunderstanding concerning these events and concerning the law and the commandments of God. What is the issue? The issue is the writings of the Apostle Paul. Paul wrote 14 letters, and some read conflict into his teachings about the law. Some have ideas about what he taught against it. Others, well, he taught for it, but he said the law was established, but then he said it was also against us. So how do we understand those? And of course, there's only, well, actually, the truth of the matter is this. There are four different laws referred to in Paul's writings. The problem comes when people think the word law, L-A-W, always refers to the same thing, either the Ten Commandments or perhaps the law of rituals. In fact, there are four different laws referred to in the writings of Paul, just like there are four applications of the term the day of the Lord. One day, 1 year, 1,000 years, and all eternity. So we want to be sure we look at those and understand them. There's only one law referred to, or if there's only one law referred to, and it means the same thing every time it is used, then we would have to conclude the Apostle Paul contradicts himself. If there are different parts of the Torah or the law, the first five books of the Bible or other writings that Paul's referring to, then his teachings become clear. Now the word law is used 78 times in the book of Romans. 78 times in the book of Romans. Now, let's start over Romans chapter 7. We're going to get some kind of background here first. But in the book of Romans, there is the law. There is the law of sin. There's the law of the mind. Paul refers to the law of the spirit of life in Jesus Christ. Paul refers to the law of sin and death several times. Paul refers to the law of righteousness in the book of Romans. What are all these laws and how do we understand them? Well, don't have time to answer that today, but I think what I will do is cover those in the Bible study this coming Wednesday evening. I'm assigned for that, and rather than keeping you here until 5 or 6 o'clock tonight, I think I'll cover those laws in Romans and how to understand them in the Bible study this coming Wednesday. So it'll be kind of a follow-up. Or the, you might say, the other half to fill in some of this. Romans chapter 7 and verse 12, to get a foundation, the Apostle Paul says, "The law is holy and the commandment is holy, just and good." He's going through a discourse here in chapter 7 about sin and how when he understood sin, it became death to him. And the commandment which was intended to bring life, he found to bring death because he found that he was guilty of breaking those commandments. Says, "For sin taking occasion by the commandment deceived me, and it killed me. Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment is holy, and just and good." Obviously, he's not teaching in Romans that the commandment or the law is done away. Let's look at a couple others. Let's go to Colossians chapter 2 and verse 14. Colossians 2:14 is often used by those who try to do away with the commandments, and the arguments of Pauline theology are used. It is one that we had this one and a number of other verses that are controversial. We've had a library of good information to over the years, going back 60 years, to correctly explain these verses. But yet, when people tried to misapply them and teach them wrongly, there were way too many who did not have the foundational understanding to recognize it for what it was. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 14 says, "Having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was taken, and he has taken it out of the way, nailing it to the cross." In the church that I grew up in, this was taught very strongly and often, that the Ten Commandments were nailed to the cross. Because this handwriting of ordinances must have been the Ten Commandments, because they're written by the finger of God, therefore they were against us. They were not against us, except that we broke them. And the penalty for breaking the commandments is death. So he wiped out that death penalty that was against us, which was contrary to us, taken it away and nailed it to the cross, having disarmed principalities and powers, meaning Satan the devil and his hold over us. That's just sort of a quick summary. But this is one of the arguments of Pauline theology, based on a misunderstanding of Colossians chapter 2 and verse 14. Can the same code of laws that is holy, just, and good, and that we established, at the same time be against us? The answer is no. Let's go back over to Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 15. Another cornerstone scripture that is used to teach that the Ten Commandments are done away, or that the law of God is no longer to be kept by Christians. And these scriptures were taught incorrectly and were written about in very, very long missives back in the 1990s. And of course, it was completely false. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 15. Let's start in verse 14. He himself is our peace, for he has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of separation. So Jesus Christ has broken down the middle wall of separation between us and our Creator, God the Father. Because he says in verse 13, in Jesus Christ you were once far off. We were all guilty. We had sinned. We were come short of the glory of God. We were far off, but we have been brought near by the blood of Christ. And we will commemorate that and give thanks for it on Passover 1 week from tomorrow night. He is our peace. He has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of separation. He has made us one with our God. Notice, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from two, thus making peace. So again, we have enmity abolished in his flesh. This is used to argue that Christ nailed, or was, the law was nailed to the cross along with Jesus Christ. Of course, that's not true. What was nailed to the cross was the sacrifice for our sins, which was Jesus Christ. He is the sacrifice, and by that sin offering, we can be reconciled to our God. So the law that said those who were breaking the law were guilty and deserving the death penalty, that death penalty was removed. Now I'm going to do a long little study here in Romans chapter 3. So if you want to go to Romans chapter 3, this entire chapter, you know, is one we obviously read during times of baptismal counseling, and we have, I think, a lot of memory scriptures just in this one chapter. But Romans chapter 3, I want to begin at the beginning. The introduction is the last few verses of chapter 2, where he's talking about circumcision, for he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. So circumcision is now spiritual. It is of the heart. We have the stony part of our heart removed, replaced by the Spirit of God. Then he asks, what advantage has the Jew, or what is the profit of circumcision, or having been born a Jew? Did he say nothing? No advantage at all. Now, he's argued in chapter 1 and chapter 2 that the Jews and the Gentiles were equally guilty of breaking God's commandments and were equally deserving of the death penalty and had the same and one and only path back to reconciliation with God. But then he says, what advantage has the Jew then? Apparently, the Jews in Rome, as in other places, were comparing themselves and saying, we have an advantage because we were born with a Jewish background and you Gentiles didn't have that, so we are, quote, better than you. Whatever they said in their arguments, I can't put those together because of what Paul says he's dealing with in his writings. So what advantage has being born Jewish to a Christian today? He says, much in every way. He didn't say a little bit, but he says much in every way, or in many ways. Most importantly, he says, chiefly or importantly, to them were committed the oracles of God. So they grew up understanding, or at least having taught to them, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, the commandments of God. The Gentiles grew up worshiping Zeus or worshiping Minerva or worshiping some other god of the Roman or the Greek pagan world. The Jews grew up understanding there was one God and understanding at least superficially his laws and commandments. Verse 3, what if some did not believe? And what if some of those Jews didn't believe those laws, didn't believe what they were taught? What if they acted in an unbelieving fashion? Will their unbelief make the faithfulness of God without effect? Just because some people didn't believe what God said, what effect does that have on what God taught? The answer is none. Verse 4, certainly not. Indeed, let God be true, but every man a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words, and you may overcome when you are judged. So here Paul is quoting basically from the Psalms that God is justified in judging the Jews because they disobeyed, and in fact perhaps even go farther, judging all of Israel and putting them into captivity because they did not, because of their unbelief, obey his commandments like they should have. Verse 5, but if our unrighteousness... So Paul is including himself here as a Jew who grew up in unbelief, grew up some superficial knowledge of the commandments and of the Pharisee religion that he grew up in, but he said it was a system of unbelief. If our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? So the religion of Judaism of that time, Paul simply describes here as unrighteousness. Now, John records a number of things that Jesus Christ said about them, like they were of their father, the devil, and his works they would do. But all of those things, you wonder, makes you wonder, why do people want to go back to Judaism and its practices when literally the Pharisaic religion has nothing good said about it in the New Testament that I can find anyway. He says, is God unjust who inflicts wrath? I speak as a man. Certainly not. For then how will God judge the world? So if it is unjust for God to inflict punishment, he said, how is Jesus Christ going to return and then judge the world? For if the truth of God has increased through my lie to his glory, why am I also still judged a sinner? So Paul is simply saying, if I had to turn my back on the lies or the falsehoods and then be able to use my life as an example to his glory, why am I also judged as a sinner? Now, let's write down a little bit farther. Verse 8. And why not say, let us do evil that good may come, as we are slanderously reported? So some people were reporting that the Apostle Paul was teaching that a form of licentiousness. People can do good. Do bad, therefore, the forgiveness of God will be that much more glorious. I think there's even some of that teaching today around that Paul had to simply say that slanderous reporting, as some affirm that we say their condemnation is just. So if they'll be judged by God and condemned by God, that will be a just thing. What then? Are we better than they? So are the Jews better than the Gentiles? Not at all. We have previously charged both Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. It says they've all turned aside, together have become unprofitable. This is basically the description of the world around us, in the world of all those whom God has not called. Most of this comes from Psalm chapter 14. So there is no fear of God before their eyes, verse 18. And we certainly see that fulfilled around us. Now let's continue on down. We know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. To be under the law simply means you understand the law and you need to live by it. You understand its penalty if it is broken. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. A little bit later in this chapter, there are several indications that Paul is dealing with a group of Jews who flaunted their works. their keeping of the law, perhaps also their ritualistic keeping of the law, and some of the rituals that Jesus Christ himself said replaced the law of God. But just on kind of the superficial understanding here of what he's saying, it's very simple, that those who are trying to justify themselves by the deeds of the law will not be justified. No flesh will justify them by the deeds of the law. For now the righteousness of God apart from the law is revealed, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Now that's a mouthful. The righteousness of God apart from the law is revealed in the law, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, and the lives of the prophets. The lives of the prophets were men who lived by faith. They were men who lived according to their very best of their ability with God's help to the commandments of God. So the law and the prophets both reveal that by the deeds of the flesh, no man will be justified, only through the righteousness of God through faith. Then he says, even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ to all and on all who believe, for there is no difference. No difference between Jew and Gentile. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Now, there are some who would teach that's a New Testament teaching. But just hold your place here. Let's go back to a few other places. 1 Kings chapter 8 and verse 46. And I'll go through these fairly quickly. You don't have to necessarily turn there. It might be good to have in your notes. 1 Kings chapter 8 and verse 46. Here in a prayer of dedication at the temple, Solomon says, when they sin against you, for there is none who does not sin. Solomon said very plainly, there's no one who does not sin. Just the same thing that Paul said in verse 23. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 20. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 20 says very plainly, and let me get over there. It says, there is not a righteous person on the earth who does good and does not sin. There is not a righteous person on the earth that does not sin. Let's also go over to Isaiah chapter 64 and verse 5. Isaiah chapter 64 and verse 5. I think he's referring here to the works of law or ergon pneumos that Paul would later talk about, write about. People trying to earn their own righteousness in the eyes of God. Isaiah 64 and verse 5 says, you meet him who rejoices and does righteous. Who remembers you in your ways, for you are indeed angry, for we have sinned. In these ways we continue, and we need to be saved. So he's talking about them, the people who rejoice in their own righteousness. They also make God angry because they need to be saved. Chapter 64 and verse 6, we are all like an unclean thing. All our righteousness are like filthy rags, and we fade as a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind have taken us away. Verse 7, there is no one who calls on your name. So the idea of Romans chapter 3 and verse 23, that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, is indeed an Old Testament teaching. It's taught several different times in the Old Testament. Verse 24 says, being justified freely by his grace, or free forgiveness. The sacrifice was made by Jesus Christ freely, not because we paid him or because we did anything to earn it. But then he continues on something here that is very important to understand in verse 25. So he's justified, or we are just, all have sinned, but all can be justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Notice verse 25, whom God set forth as a propitiation by his blood. Now, none of us use that word. It's an old English word that meant payment for in place of, but the Greek word here actually is kapara, and the kapara was the covering seat on the Ark of the Covenant. Only appears two times in the New Testament. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 5, and here in Romans chapter 3 and verse 25. It means the mercy seat which formed the Ark of the Covenant, the cover of it in the Holy of Holies in the temple. The high priest was only able to enter there once a year and offer a sacrifice for the sins of the people. It corresponds to this, the root meaning of the word, and the root meaning of the word in Greek also simply means to wipe clean. Jesus Christ was set forth by God as a way of wiping completely clean, completely away by his blood through faith the sins of all mankind. Now, this is an interesting sidelight, but there are practicing Jews, those who are Orthodox or practicing Jews today, who are hard-pressed to give the answer to the question that since there is no temple, it has been destroyed, sacrifices can no longer be offered in the manner that God requires in the Torah or the first five books of Moses. So what is the mercy seat? What is the kapara for sins, since there is no mercy seat in the realm of Judaism? There is for us because Jesus Christ is our mercy seat. We just read so in Paul's writings. So if you wonder why they really want to build a third temple or why they want to reconstruct another temple in Jerusalem, in the mind of the Orthodox Jews, at least from some of the sources I can find, is because they really want to have that Ark of the Covenant there and have a kapara or a mercy seat where they can again offer sacrifices on behalf of their national sins. And perhaps as a result of that, regain their national blessings from God, because the covenant they think they are under is the old covenant, which promised to them peace, land, blessings, rain in due season, and they want to have that again. So the correct answer to the question is given in this verse, and that is that Jesus Christ is the covering seat. He is the kapara or the mercy seat. So God set him forth as a propitiation or as a mercy seat by his blood through faith to demonstrate his righteousness, because in his forbearance God had passed over the sins that were previously committed. So when we are baptized, we acknowledge that mercy seat, that sacrifice that was given on our behalf. It is for sins that were previously committed. It is not a preemptive forgiveness for sins you plan to do in the future. I think that was probably pretty clearly made to you when you counseled for baptism. There are some religions that falsely teach, of course, pagan ideas that that's not the case, that they can somehow in advance atone for sins they're going to commit in the future. But at any rate, it's important for us to understand this verse is clear, that the atonement is made for sins that were previously committed. That kapara and that mercy is there available to us when we sin and we go again to God's throne and ask for forgiveness and throw ourselves on his mercy for that. Notice, to demonstrate that the present time his righteousness, that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. So he is just and he is the justifier of those who have faith in Jesus Christ. Verse 27, where is boasting then? Okay, who was boasting? What is he addressing? Who was doing the boasting here that he has to address, talk about? Well, it was the Jews who were convinced that works of law can earn them a way to salvation. It's basically the law of works. And that was essentially what he's talking about in verse 27. Romans uses the term ergon pneumos, or works of law, one time. Galatians has it, I believe, five times, and it's one more time, I believe, in Ephesians, or I'm sorry, in Hebrews. So these works of law, verse 28, therefore we conclude that a man is justified by faith apart from deeds of the law, or ergon pneumos. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means, according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, the MMQ scroll, it was purity laws, making sure that your dishes didn't come into contact with those who were impure, and a whole host of other regulations that were concocted by the Pharisees, or at least by the Essenes, to make sure that they were not becoming impure. But works of law, in a larger sense, simply means obeying or living meticulously by the laws that given through Moses, the law of Moses we talked about last time. We conclude that a man is justified by faith apart from deeds of the law. So we are justified by the forgiveness made possible by Jesus Christ, not by continuing to do the best we can to obey God, that does not make up for our past sins. Notice the subject in verse 25 was the sins that were previously committed. Nothing we can do can make up for that, except to accept Jesus Christ's sacrifice and let his sacrifice make it up or be the payment for us. Verse 29, is he the God of the Jews only, or is he not also the God of the Gentiles? Yes, of the Gentiles also. If it were works of law, he would be the God of the Jews only. And that is, unfortunately, the teaching today still of modern-day Phariseeism. Since there is one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith, do we then make the law void through faith? Now that would be, of course, the teachings of that began kind of with Martin Luther. But do we make the law void through faith? The answer is certainly not, or absolutely not. But unfortunately, with God, if God says, don't believe this, people will believe it and teach it. But as Paul said very plainly, the law, I mean, in this case, the Torah, all the commandments of God, everything that was written in the law, is that made void through faith? In other words, you don't have to keep the law. It no longer applies to us because of faith. The answer is certainly not. On the contrary, we establish the law. So Romans 3 is a very challenging chapter for those who would teach the law is done away, because he goes through all the arguments about it and then says, no, we establish the law. Now, just to illustrate the issue that I want to make sure is clear in everyone's mind, this is the teaching of the Lutheran Church. This is published 1983 by Word and World, Luther Seminary, St. Paul, Minnesota. And the author of this article on concept of the law was a man named Walter Bowman. I would imagine he was a faculty member there. Actually, he says he's faculty member at the Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. He writes, one theme almost as characteristic of the Lutheran tradition as justification by faith is law and gospel. Indeed, the two themes are closely related. The Lutheran opposite of justification by faith is justification by works of the law. Both themes have come under criticism. Justification because it is no longer relevant, law and gospel because it is not faithful to biblical exegesis. Now that first statement there I think is important because it has had an effect on the quote Christian world that we live in today. This was in the 1980s when many of these seeds were sown in the modern day, what they call the emerging church movement. He simply says in there, justification is no longer relevant. In other words, you don't have to be justified. You just have to come to church, enjoy yourself, accept Jesus, start in your own good works, in your own ministry, whatever it might be. The come as you are, the health and wealth gospel, the complete lack in some gospel messages about real repentance and the need to obey God is simply gone because of this concept that justification, because it no longer is relevant, has infected many, many churches, many, many Christian, quote, belief systems in this country. Well, let's continue. Both criticisms center on the concept of the law, and they could be traced back to Martin Luther's own lifetime. The antinomian controversy, antinomian means against the law, the antinomian controversy, which began in 1527, challenged the application of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, to Christians. So in 1527, there was a challenge to the Ten Commandments saying the Christians no longer have to keep the Ten Commandments. It goes back to Martin Luther and his movement. It said it led to the controversies about the third use of law. What is new about the criticisms in recent biblical scholarship is that the new understanding of Paul and the Sinaitic legislation have brought biblical exegesis into direct conflict with the Lutheran Book of Concord. So he's saying the new understandings are in conflict with that idea. Continuing on down, says, Paul does not proclaim God's grace in Christ as deliverance from the plight of failing to achieve salvation through the works of law. Rather, Paul begins with a conviction that in Jesus the Christ, the eschatological salvation of God has occurred. What this means for Paul is now Jesus has become the ground of salvation for both Jews and Gentiles as a consequence of faith in Christ has replaced and now excludes the law. To continue in the law is now sin because it is a rejection of God's eschatological salvation in Christ. I thought that was very plain. There were teachings that were foisted off on the church years ago that if we continued to keep the Sabbath, we were somehow earning our salvation, and it was somehow offensive to God. We couldn't do that anymore. So I don't think that's at all true, but I want you to know where the source of some of these things is for the Pauline theology and the antinomian ideas that are going around today. My guess is they're kind of like mushrooms in the springtime. They pop up quickly sometimes when you don't expect it, and I think they're going to be popping up again. Now let's go to let's go to James chapter 2 and verse 10. James chapter 2 and verse 10. Don't have time today, we might do have time in Bible study, to review the truth that James taught about faith and works, and how the same truth is taught by the Apostle Paul, just in slightly different words, because there are many who teach that faith makes the law void. Of course, it doesn't. The law can refer at least four separate understandings, as we mentioned here, but James chapter 2 and verse 10 says, we are going to be judged by the law. Verse 10, whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, he is guilty of all. Now, he's very plain to let us know which law he's talking about because he gives us two of the commandments. He who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. We understand those two commandments. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but you do murder, you'll become a transgressor of the law. So speak and so do as those who'll be judged by the law of liberty. So the law is described here. The Ten Commandments he's referring to is described by the law of liberty, and he cites them. You know, sometimes we have to look at the circumstance or the background of what's happening to understand what law he's talking about, what law the author is talking about. Years and years ago when they did westerns, sometimes the sheriff would tell the person he was going to arrest to stop in the name of the law. Now, he wasn't talking about speeding laws. They probably didn't have them back then. He was talking about the law of the province or the state he was in, perhaps the law of whatever law they had perhaps broken. An interesting sidelight in American history, when Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys took Fort Ticonderoga, and I believe 1777, Ethan Allen walked into the fort, found the British commander, and he said, surrender in the name of the law and of the great Jehovah God. So he actually told the British to surrender in the name of God's law. That was, you know, pretty colorful and certainly worked for a while. But they all understood what he was talking about. And many of the American revolutionaries were very much put off by the corruption and the immorality of the British generals and officers that had come to the New World, and so they were really, it was kind of a righteous war in the minds of many of them. So James says the Ten Commandments are the law of liberty, and it is in effect today. It's not gone away. We'll have time later, I hope, to discuss a lot more about what James says concerning law and faith, or works and faith. But I think it's important for us to go back now to Deuteronomy chapter 4, because we're going to be talking about these changes that have taken place between the Old and the New Covenant. And in this case, we have to look at the laws. We're going to begin looking at the laws that were given at Sinai. In order to understand the Exodus, in, say, chapters 19 through the end of the book of Exodus, you have to first read what Moses said almost 40 years later in the book of Deuteronomy. Because Moses is rehearsing for this younger generation, who were all basically under 20 years old, what happened back at Mount Sinai. Probably the oldest person in his audience, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb, the oldest person would have been 59 years old. Now, that used to seem to be like a very, very old person, but the older you get, you think, well, that's not quite so old. But he had to tell all of these youngsters, who probably many of them were aware of what happened on Mount Sinai, but he wanted to make sure that they knew. And so Deuteronomy gives us Moses' correct rendition of the events at Mount Sinai. Let's begin in chapter 4 and verse 1. Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you. This, you might say, is one of the final teachings of a man who's going to die soon. So the last words of a dying person, so to speak. There's quite a number of those in the scriptures. They all have some very important lessons for us. So he says, verse 2, you shall not add to the word that I command you, nor take from it. That phrase is repeated throughout the Bible a number of times. We are not to add to the word that God gave us, which the Pharisaic religion is built upon, all those things that were added back in the time of the captivity in Babylon and going forth after that in history. You shall not add to what God said, and you shall not take away from it, not take away from what I command you, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor, for the Lord your God was destroyed, or has destroyed from among you all the men who followed Baal of Peor. So what did the men of Baal Peor teach? What happened there? Well, it was wholesale adultery with the ladies of the land around them. So one of the first warnings that Moses gives these people is keep yourselves from the women of the land. Don't commit adultery and fornication with them. It will destroy your nation. It says, but you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me. So notice this. The Ten Commandments were written in long form on two tablets of stone by the finger of God. But the rest of the statutes and judgments were dictated by God and were written down first on paper and then later on that memorial that was set up across the Jordan River in the Promised Land a number of times. But that is the list of the statutes and judgments that God gave Moses. That is the law of Moses. That is the law that was transmitted by the mediator. The people of Israel heard the Ten Commandments and they understood them when God thundered them. That was not given in the hand of a mediator. It was the judgments and the statutes that were given by Moses in the hand of a mediator. So he says here very carefully, I have taught you statutes and judgments just as the Lord my God commanded me that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes. And surely say, this great nation is a wise and understanding people. Now, last time we left off in the Deuteronomy chapters, 11 through about 22, 23, which were the body of statutes and judgments that were to be the law for Israel when they occupied the Promised Land. You know, we have who knows how many hundreds of millions of laws today or pages of laws. They were to have that section of laws, and God said, don't add to it, don't take away from it. And if we had adhered much closer to that principle and that law, our nation would be doing so much better today. But they were to be an example. Verse 7, other people will say, what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day? That probably came to pass when Solomon was king. It was a rare experience, honestly, in the 700-year history of the people of Israel. They didn't fulfill this commandment because they got involved in sin of all different kinds. But notice this, verse 9, take heed to yourself. Be very strongly warned. Take heed and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. And teach them to your children and your grandchildren. So take heed that you don't lose what you know, the things that you have seen. And what's the one thing he wanted them to especially teach their children? I hope every parent and grandparent in here reads this next verse and says, I must do this. What do you teach your children and grandchildren? Concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God at Sinai or Horeb, when the Lord said to me, gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn and fear me all the days that they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children. So God said very specifically, we are to teach our children the events of Mount Sinai and how God gave the commandments. And of course, beyond that, the sin of the golden calf and other things that occurred. Verse 11, you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire in the midst of heaven with darkness and cloud and thick darkness. And the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of his words, but you didn't see him. You didn't see any form. You only heard a voice. So he declared to you his covenant. God declared to you those commandments, which he commanded you to perform, the Ten Commandments, and he wrote them on two tablets of stone. So God wrote the Ten Commandments in long form, the longest one being the fourth. Now, we most of us have plaques in our house, and we have these shortened form of the commandments. We shorten them down to three or four or five words. There are a few that are short, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. But the longer ones, I think we would be better off to have the long form, because that's what God actually wrote. And there's a reason why God wrote them in that way. But let's continue on down. Verse 13, he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, the Ten Commandments. He wrote them on two tablets of stone. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that you might observe them in the land which you cross over to possess. So God spoke the Ten Commandments, they heard it, and then Moses later passed on to them the statutes and the judgments that they were to observe. Verse 15, take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest you act corruptly and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of any figure, likeness of male or female. And of course, of the various animals and other things that people in the Middle East would use as idolatrous images. So he says, don't even think you saw a form of God. We have all sorts of illegitimate, incorrect, and misleading forms of God all around the nation today, all sorts of them. But of course, God's people understand those are all false. We don't picture those in our mind when we pray. Let's drop down verse 20. But the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace out of Egypt to be his people and inheritance as you are today. We must not forget that God has called us out of the iron furnace of the land in which we live, because we live in a land that's just as evil and certainly just as dangerous. And in some ways perhaps we're going to be slaves like the ancient Israelites were in a matter of a few years. We'll just wait and see what God has for us there. But verse 24 says, the Lord your God is a consuming fire and a jealous God. Now let's go back to, let's look at just chapter 5 real quickly, Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 1. Moses called all Israel and said to them, hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your hearing today, that you may observe and learn them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us who are here today, all of us who are alive. So the covenant was passed down to those people. They agreed to it. In fact, three different times in Exodus 19 through 25, we have the people of Israel promising that they will obey God. So the Lord talked with you face to face on the mountain from the midst of the fire. They heard his voice but didn't see his form. I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up to the mountain. And then he said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land, house of Egypt, out of the land of bondage. And all the way down to verse 21 then is the long form of those Ten Commandments. Verse 22, these words the Lord spoke to all your assembly in the mountain from the midst of the fire, the cloud and the thick darkness with a loud voice. And he added no more, and he wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. So that's what God wrote. That's what the hand of God wrote. Now let's go back to Exodus chapter 20 and find out then what would be considered as the law of Moses, what would be considered as delivered to Israel at the hand of the mediator. And then, of course, that mediator being Moses. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 21, this is after the Ten Commandments are given there, and God told Moses to basically come up to him. Verse 20, Moses said to the people, "Don't fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you that you may not sin." So this demonstration of God's power was to instill the fear of God in them. Sadly, it didn't take very well. The people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. The Lord said to Moses, "You shall say to the children of Israel, 'You have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall not make anything to be with me, gods or silver or gold, you shall not make for yourselves. But an altar of earth you shall make for me. You shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I record, I will bless you. If you make an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone, for if you use your tool on it, you have profaned it. Nor shall you go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed." It had to have a ramp going up to it. So at the end of the Ten Commandments, there is an instruction given by God for them to build an altar for two purposes: peace offerings and burnt offerings. Sin offerings are not mentioned. This is not a sin offering. This altar that was to be built by the people of Israel or by Moses was for the purpose of people giving thanks and giving thanks for the peace they experienced and giving their free will offerings. The concept of a sin offering being given came later. Now, verse 21, "These are the judgments which you shall set before them." So these are the judgments that God dictated to Moses, beginning here in chapter 21. And what more shall we talk? What can we say about them? Well, these were the judgments that were to be given to the people of Israel. So when they went to the land of the promise, when they were entered into the promised land, they were settled in their estates. These chapters, these next three chapters, tell us how to apply the commandments to everyday life. That's what judgments are. How you apply the commandments to everyday life. So they concern things like slavery. You couldn't have a slave who was oppressed. After 7 years or 6 years, he would be released, had the option of being released. There was a modicum of fairness and fair treatment in the subject of those who became slaves. Now, today we call it getting a job. Back then they called it selling themselves into slavery so they get themselves financially in better shape. But that's a different subject. But there are other subjects here. Concerning women, concerning how women were to be protected, that they were not to be abused by their husband, and they were to have, you might say, women's rights. There's a section on stealing. How do you apply against the law against thou shalt not steal? And of course, there are a number of those who talk about that. What about if men fight? Also, there are applications here about accidental death. What if somebody commits manslaughter? Also, laws concerning animals. What if your bull goes over and gores your neighbor's sheep to death? There are laws about adultery, how to determine adultery and what the penalty was going to be. In verse 21, we have protection for basically weak people. And it's just interesting how God has responsibility for property, responsibility for animals. Verse 21 of chapter 22. It says, "You shall neither mistreat a stranger nor oppress him, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any way, and they cry at all to me, I will surely hear their cry. My wrath will become hot, and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless." So there was a strong prohibition here against afflicting those who were needy, the weak people among them. There were also instructions about lending money and how they would be able to recover that and how business dealings should take place. Chapter 23, warnings about gossip. You shall not circulate a false report. You know, we still deal with that today in our nations every day, all the time, but sadly in the Church of God from time to time, there are false reports and people believe them and make very regrettable decisions. Verse 2, you shall not follow a crowd to do evil. That still happens today also. Nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to justice. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. Same thing James would later teach about. Now, at the end of chapter 23, we pretty much have the end of a summary of this group of statutes and judgments that they were to give. They were to understand. Moses was to write them down, later write them down on probably a very large scroll, put them on the side of the box of the Ark of the Covenant. The Ten Commandments that God wrote with his finger were to be kept in the Ark of the Covenant, but the scroll with the law of Moses was on the side of the Ark of the Covenant in a slot or a side compartment. Verse 24, now he said to Moses, this is God talking to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. So here we have 74 men who are going up the hill. Now, this is after they had promised in chapter 19, a little bit later, that they would obey God no matter what. In this case, we have the third promise. There's kind of a finiteness to the number of threes. You know, Paul asked God three times to heal him, and he said no. Jesus Christ was tested three times by Satan the devil, and of course, Satan the devil lost. Many other examples of threes in the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar was tried three times in the book of Daniel, and we go through a number of those that I think are good biblical understanding guidelines. So what happened here is Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel came up to worship from afar off, but the people didn't come along. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments. So Moses read to them this scroll of chapters 21, 22, 23. And the people said with one voice, all the words which the Lord has said we will do. They gave their consent. They promised, we will obey God and we will do this. Now we're going to find out pretty soon just how much they meant that. Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain, the 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Those were to signify that this covenant had been ratified and agreed to by both parties. Notice, he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings and of oxen to the Lord. So here we didn't have any Levites yet, any priesthood set aside yet. There were Levites, you know, just according to their family. But at this time, Moses had young men who gave offerings on behalf of all the people, each one of these pillars representing a tribe of Israel. And Moses took half the blood and put it in their basins, and he sprinkled on the altar, and he took the book of the covenant and read in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has said, we will do. So the covenant was read, these three chapters were read to all the people of Israel. And the people said, we will do that, we will be obedient. And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, this is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to all these words. And Moses went up also with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu and the 70 elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. So in this case, they saw a form of God. We know it was a very brightly shining form, not in his strength, not in his full strength at all. The Shekinah glory, or this shining, glittering, kind of a sea of glass under his feet was there. Under his feet was a paved work of sapphire stone, like the very heavens in its clarity. On the nobles of children of Israel, he did not lay his hands. He never touched them, but they saw God, and they ate and drank. So here was this sort of a consummation meal, a type of the coming wedding supper that they had. Then the Lord said to Moses, come up to me in the mountain, and I will give you tables of stone and the law and commandments, which I have written, that you may teach them. So come up and get these two tables that I have made. So Moses went up into the mountain. Verse 17, the sight of the glory of the Lord was like the consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the midst of the children of Israel. So here we have Moses going up. And the people of these other men were supposed to simply stay by the mountain and stay there, to stay there until he came back. But, of course, they didn't do that. They very quickly went back down to I guess, wherever they were camped, at the foot of Mount Sinai. And then, of course, we know what happened with the time of the golden calf. So 74 men went up to the mountain. Moses told the people all of these words. Verse 12, we already mentioned that. Moses, the Lord said to Moses, come up to me in the mountain, I will give you tablets of stone, which I have written. Moses arose with his assistant, Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. But what I want to mention here is verse 14. He said to the elders, wait here for us until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them. So Moses went up into the mountain, and a cloud covered the mountain. So you have 72 men sort of halfway up the mountain right as the cloud started, and that's where they saw the form of God. Then we have Joshua and Moses going up farther. Joshua goes a certain distance and stops, and then Moses goes on up. And he's up there 40 days and 40 nights. So these people who are halfway up the mountain, these 72 men, start getting cold feet. They started wondering, where's this Moses guy? I'm getting hungry, and I'm getting cold up here. Let's go back to our wives. Let's go back to our you know, good food back there. And so they had a great falling away, you might say. It doesn't tell us that conversation. God never inspired that to be written down. We just know that when Moses came back down, he heard this sound of the great party, the orgy that was going on. And, of course, it was a very upsetting thing. Now, God knew that the people of Israel did not have the heart that they needed. So he began to set up here and gave instructions to Moses in the next chapters, about six chapters, after this time when Moses went up on the mountain. God gave him the tablets, but he also gave him the instructions for constructing the tabernacle. And we have the instructions for the mercy seat, chapter 25 and verse 17. You shall make a kaparet, or a mercy seat. And we just read back in Romans that this represented Jesus Christ himself. He was the kaparet, or the mercy seat offering, given for all of our lives. And of course, he had to make the cherubim, and he had to have all of these various instructions about the structure of the tabernacle, all the various garments they were to wear, the furniture in the tabernacle. All of this took place between, all these instructions are given to us here, all the way until chapter 31. Chapter 31 is interesting because God then tells him who are the names of these men who were to be able to keep, who were going to build the fancy garments, who were going to put the gold vessels together to build the table, to build the altar of showbread, all the various things. Then he says in verse 13, also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbath you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that it is he who sanctifies you. So here we have God reminding them again that when they went to the promised land, they were to keep the Sabbath days. They were to keep the days that were given by God as an instruction for them. And so this is in simply, you know, long before any of the objections about the Sabbath of the holy days would have come about. Then verse 32, of course, we have, or chapter 32, we have, let's read verse 8, chapter 31, verse 18. When he had made an end of speaking with him on Mount Sinai, he gave Moses two tablets of the testimony. This is after restating the importance of the Sabbath and the work that was to be done. And then when he came back down the mountain, they heard about the noise and, of course, the golden calf that happened. And we have a very sad story here to the lack of leadership of Aaron. He was an example of spiritual failure here, and demonstrated the need for God's Spirit to live in people before they could then have the forgiveness or the character to obey God. Chapter 32 and verse 35 ends this way. The Lord plagued the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron made. So here we have sad human effort to obey God. This is what happens when people try to obey God without God's Spirit. Eventually they fail, and eventually they go into one form or another of idolatry. So this law that was given to them was given so that they could keep it in the promised land. The law of Moses was, as we mentioned last time, to be put in the side of the Ark of the Covenant, and it was to be their law book for the time they were in the promised land. That law did not contain anything about immortality or about forgiveness of spiritual sin. It was all concerning the physical promises that God gave them. So next time we will get into the first of the seven changes. And I think with this background information, we should be able to arrive at a pretty clear understanding of the subject.